to welcome you to today's partnership call, which is co-hosted by CHE and the Science and Environmental Health Network. The title of today's call is Cumulative Impacts on Health, New Community-Based Research Projects. This is the second of a two-part call series. Our moderator today is Elise Miller, CHE's director. We have set up a blog in association with today's call. You can post comments or questions on the blog, and we will do our best to get to all of them. To find the blog, you go to the CHE homepage at healthandenvironment.org. Select the call link for today's call from the left-hand box, and you can then follow that link to the blog. I have muted everyone on the call right now, with the exception of our speakers and our moderator. At the end of the conversation, we will open up the call for a Q&A session. This call is scheduled to last an hour and a half. We'll see if we need all of that time. It is being recorded, and an MP3 file will be available for downloading on the CHE website soon. And with that, I hope you enjoy the call this morning, and I will turn things over to Elise.
Great. Thank you, Erica. Erica does such an amazing job organizing and helping with the logistics. We couldn't do these calls without her, so much appreciation. And welcome to everyone on the call. The one person who is going to present briefly who is not able to join us today is Devin Sturges, Payne Sturges, and she had to attend a funeral and is very apologetic that she could not be present for this call. But she did send me a few notes, some of which she described on the first part of this series. But I wanted to share those thoughts from her with you all, and then Carolyn Raffensperger will say a few words, and then we'll move into the presentations. And so I'm reading this piece a bit, so forgive the it's not a very melodic tone, but this is from Devin Payne Sturges, and she notes that the EPA has had a longstanding interest in and made a contribution to cumulative risk assessment, starting with chemical mixtures guidance in 1986. And in 2004, the EPA's National Environmental Justice Action Committee submitted a report to the administrator on cumulative impacts, demanding that the agency consider social context and community characteristics that make population groups more vulnerable. The agency is still struggling with this and how to address the social context, the psychosocial hazards for which the evidence is building on how social context drives disparities in exposure and how social stressors compound the toxic effects of exposures to environmental contaminants. So in 2007, Devin's office, the National Center on Environmental Research and the EPA's National Center for Computational Toxicology hosted a workshop on data and research needs for risk assessment. And that was conducted at the community level, which would require consideration of community vulnerability characteristics. And this workshop led to the solicitation that has generated these seven EPA grants that was awarded under what is called the STAR, S-T-A-R, CAPS program. And the award has $7 million to fund these cumulative health risk assessment research. And there definitely is a heightened interest at the EPA on these issues, and there are many people among the risk assessors that are concerned that the science on these issues is not mature enough, but it seems very important that the STAR grants serve as kind of the cutting edge of research. That's the end of Devin's comments, and I will simply add that last week's call, the first of this series, was very informative, and it's this interesting balance to me of knowing that there's been this decades of deep and difficult work by communities and community leaders and others to bring these issues to the forefront and help the rest of us understand the myriad impacts on the community's health. And it is really, I sort of feel like we're playing catch-up by finally funding this kind of research. And at the same time, I want to laud and applaud the fact that this research actually is happening and that we have community-based leaders participating and the researchers are deeply engaged. So it's both of that, and I just but I'm so looking forward to hearing the rest of the projects But before I introduce the presenters, I will turn this over to Carolyn Raffensperger. Again, we're so pleased that the Collaborative on Health and the Environment and Science and Environmental Health Network are co-sponsoring this call and the Cumulative Impacts Project. So, Carolyn.
I'm Carolyn Raffensperger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. And I should acknowledge that Madeline Scammell, who will be presenting on this call, is the president of the network. And I've had a long affiliation with her around community-based research. And what I want to do is frame this call around community-based research and cumulative impacts by stepping back a little bit. In 1998, the incoming president of AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, published a remarkable article in Science magazine that called for a new social contract for science and scientists, and essentially acknowledged that the scientific agenda and the contract that we had had with scientists, as a matter of the public good, had been to research things like how to end infectious disease or how to treat infectious disease, the space program, but especially how to enhance economic competitiveness. And Jane Lubchenco, in that article in 1998, said, "We have dealt with those problems in many ways, and we'll still need to do things like address infectious disease. But we have a new social contract that's laid before us, and the need to look at the and advance a science agenda that looks at the human changes on the planet is really what's needed now, in this century, at this time in the life of the planet and the life of humanity." And the call for this new social contract that would look at things that are very different than, say, sending people to the moon or sending the rover to Mars, that we would look at the things that are truly threatening life on Earth, things like that. And at the time, in 1998, I was working with the Loka Institute, where Madeline Scammell was a staff member, and we began looking at how we would put forward a public interest research agenda, since almost all the funding in research was directed at global economic competitiveness and making more widgets and gadgets and things that would enhance the balance of trade, things like that. And we were working, and Madeline is certainly one of the world's experts on community-based research, and how we would essentially carry out a public interest research agenda. And it was obvious that scientists sitting alone in the university really did not have a handle on the kinds of problems that communities were facing, and that the kind of science that we were familiar with did not address the complexity of, say, the cumulative impacts that communities were experiencing. And out of a number of experiments going on around the world, community-based research was really developed as a form of public interest research. And I see this call as a manifestation of extraordinary work that brings together communities and scientists to not just develop knowledge, but to develop wisdom. And so it is a special honor to be part of this call. And what we now know is that the kind of environmental decisions that we were making based on the risk assessment of chemical by chemical or facility by facility missed the larger ecological context, the larger social context that communities were actually living in, that individuals were living in. And out of the knowledge that some communities were affected differently and had a larger burden of, say, pollution or less access to beautiful places like parks, the environmental justice community really led us to an understanding that cumulative impacts and the precautionary principle and how we would address cumulative impacts was at the center of environmental justice issues. And so the focus on cumulative impacts was really led by community groups who were striving for justice. So it's a particular honor for me to be part of this call bringing together community-based research and the science of complexity. And the hope that I have is that this work really does lead us to justice and to ecological sanity. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. Very well put, and all I can say is ditto. And much appreciation for your part in articulating what needs to happen. So thank you again. I will now introduce the first sort of pairing of our community leader and researcher, and those are Dr. Deborah Corey Schlechta, and she is professor of environmental medicine at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. And her community partner is Katrina Kaufmacher, who's with the, at the University of Rochester, the School of Medicine and Dentistry. So, Debbie, do you want to go ahead and start?
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about our grant, and I'll preface that by explaining how we got into it. But I'd also need to note that I do have to leave this call, unfortunately, early. By three, because I have to chair another conference call immediately thereafter, so hopefully people will pardon me. We actually started working on lead and stress several years ago, back in about 2003 or 2004, for some very specific reasons. Looking at lead exposure, low-level lead exposure, it was particularly clear that levels had declined in children, but they were what I call demographically circumscribed. So that is, they still preferentially targeted low SES communities, particularly medically underserved inner city children. And it was striking to me that the models, that the animal models that we were using weren't very reminiscent. They weren't really very good mimics of those environments because, A, there were a lot of other chemical exposures that occurred in conjunction with lead, as well as a lot of other risk factors for diseases and disorders in low SES communities, higher levels of diseases and disorders, even if you control for access to medical care. And one hypothesis for that had always been higher levels of stress in those environments and therefore higher levels of stress hormones. And we asked, therefore, lead and stress being co-occurring risk factors. And I think the other driver for us was that if you looked at the outcomes, especially for children, of low-level lead exposure and things like prenatal stress or early stress challenges, they were remarkably similar outcomes, and there were remarkable similarities in the biological targets of those. So it was natural to ask whether or not those kinds of effects of the two of them together could be additive or even synergistic or enhanced. And that's what started us down the path of asking those questions. And we found many examples of behavioral effects of combined lead and stress that, first of all, look very different from lead alone, which really reinforced our way of thinking. But also, there were additive or synergistic consequences, not only for behavior, but for brain neurochemistry and corticosterone, other kinds of markers. And as we and differed significantly by gender in almost every single case. And so as the EPA moved forward and put out its request for applications, we had been and been, had talked about including stress in cumulative risk. Our question, and this really framed the application that we put in, was, okay, as we move in this direction, first of all, we need to know how general are these enhanced effects of lead and stress. So if we begin to look at other kinds of cognitive outcomes in animal models, will we still see synergistic effects, or are they very restricted to what we happen to look at? Are they showing up in other biochemical markers? And that framed part of our application. But we felt the question needed to be even broader in terms of thinking about risk assessment, and that is, what about other metals in stress? And the reason we asked about that was because, first of all, if you look at the scientific literature, almost every metal, whether it's an essential metal or a non-essential metal to the body, seems to result in changes in stress hormones, no matter how it's measured. And in fact, if you look at the receptors for those stress hormones, they have metal binding sites. And taken together, those kinds of data would suggest that, in fact, you might see these kind of interaction effects, additive or enhanced effects, even with other kinds of metals. And so part of our grant will not only extend low-level lead and stress to other behavioral outcomes, but we'll also be looking at the effects of combined methylmercury exposure and stress, as well as combined effects of low levels of arsenic and stress, all primarily for cognitive kinds of outcomes, for behavior, and for other kinds of markers in the CNS. And that's basically what we'll be asking. And one thing we're going to be able to do on top of that, because we have our Rochester cohort database, this was our study published in 2003, it was really the first one of children whose blood leads never went above 10. We have lots of behavioral data from those children, including IQ, but also very specific measures of learning and memory and attention. And we also asked mothers about stress levels on several occasions. So we're actually going to go back in that database and see if we can find any interactions between how stressful they perceive their environment to be and the blood lead behavior relationship with stress as a potential modifier of that. So that's basically what we'll be doing in this segment of the grant.
Great. Thank you, Debbie. That was a great overview. Katrina.
Sure. So as Debbie pointed out, this is a rat study. So when she invited me to participate with a CBPR component, I scratched my head for a little while thinking, how can you do that with rats? And then I realized that what was really critical at this juncture was to think about the messages that are coming out of this important new research and how different groups are going to receive that, make meaning of it, and then what the so what question for them is. So we designed our CBPR component around the idea that, as for most of these projects, and as was referred to in the introduction, the idea that non-chemical factors like stress and environmental exposures like lead can interact is at one level very intuitive, and it's the lived experience of communities that are part of the EJ movement. But the scientific understanding of how this might actually happen mechanistically is really just taking off. And that's a pretty unusual situation to be in when you're thinking about community outreach and educating, where the science is in some ways validating and catching up with this shared understanding that communities have. So that makes it a very interesting question of what is the significance of this new scientific understanding and the remaining uncertainties for different kinds of groups that are concerned about these issues. So, for example, most of us can imagine how this growing scientific understanding might change how we approach risk assessment, but there are probably lots of other implications for local policies, human services, built environment, promoting mental wellness, for medical practice, or for community organizing. And before we even start talking about how to communicate the findings of this kind of research, we need to understand more about those implications. So the goal of our CBPR component is to determine what this research means to different kinds of groups, and at the same time to ask them what the best way to share these findings with them is. So our goal is to find out what are their questions, what implications does it have for their work, community, or clients. What else do they want to know? Who else needs to know? And what's the best way to communicate? And recognizing that the answers to these questions may vary by group and target audience, our goal is to partner with a diverse range of kinds of organizations to develop products and approaches to meet as wide a range of needs as possible. So the way we're going to do this is start out by convening focus groups in this first year of the grant and targeting at least five different diverse types of groups to whom the research outcomes may be very relevant. I'm going to focus on that in the next couple of minutes, but I just want to tell you what we'll do after that. We will use what we learned from those focus groups to develop educational and outreach materials and have some additional focus groups to get input on that. Again, how to make meaning that's appropriate for different target audiences out of this research. In the third year, to pilot test those with a different set of groups, and then the fourth year to focus on dissemination and then getting feedback from people's reactions to those products. So I just want to tell you a little bit more about how we plan to run these focus groups in the first year. We hope to have at least one community group working with our local health systems agency and the African American Health Leadership Task Force and Latino Health Leadership Task Force, at least one environmental group, a health interest group, probably our local perinatal network or possibly the Learning Disabilities Association. We want to talk to some government stakeholders, particularly in local health departments or local branches of the DEC. And then the fifth group that we want to target is medical researchers and clinicians who aren't directly involved in this line of research, because we think it has implications for people in lots of different research areas, and if they can really understand and imagine how this is relevant, it'll help move the research agenda forward. So when we first started thinking about how to run these focus groups, we thought, well, what we really want to know is what these groups' current understanding of the health effects and of chemical and non-chemical stressors are. But we pretty quickly realized that that would be not a very productive way to start a conversation. You get kind of a blank look. What do you mean by the interactions of chemical and non-chemical stressors? So instead, we're going to start with a brief conversation about how the groups' work and interests relate to lead, how they relate to stress, and ask them whether they see any connections between the two. And then we'll have a presentation talking generally about the thrust of this research, kind of the overview that Debbie just shared of where it's coming from, what the hypotheses are, and what the initial findings are, and then have a conversation about, okay, so now that you understand what we're trying to learn and why, what other questions do you have? What more would you like to know? What do these findings suggest for your work or personal concerns? And who else needs to get this information? Then we'll, of course, analyze the results of those focus groups for themes and how, try to understand how these different groups make meaning of this, the research, document their questions, advice, and advice on how to explain the research to others, and that will form the basis for our educational materials that we'll use in the later years. And that's all I have for now.
Great, Katrina. I really appreciate your elaborating on that, and I suspect there are a number of questions for both of you, but what I'm hoping, I know, Debbie, you need to leave early, but I'm hoping that we can have all the presentations and still have you on for a little part of the Q&A. So I'm going to move now to Stephen Linder, who's Professor and Associate Director of the Institute for Health Policy at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. And Stephen said that they are so early in their process that they haven't figured out the community partnership or leadership at this point. So that is why he's not paired, but look forward to hearing more about your project. Stephen?
Thank you. Our study is primarily a methodologically oriented study, and most of the data that we use have been gathered by others, and we use a large component of administrative data that I'll detail in just a second. But the important taking off point was a study of the origins of health disparities that was done by our colleagues at the University of Texas Medical Branch in 2005. And what they wanted to do was understand, going back to neighborhood factors and other social determinants, the origins of health disparities with respect to mortality risks for a wide variety of diseases, and to understand the prevalence of certain forms of chronic disease that seem to parallel a large number of indicators of social disadvantage. And so they saw stress, both of a psychosocial kind and of a physiological kind, as mediators between conditions in the neighborhood and other structural features and some social characteristics having an impact on these health outcomes that they were monitoring. Now, the real advantage for us was that in order to get at a full conception of physiological stress, they ended up with 15 serum-based biomarkers of stress that are predictive of a variety of disease outcomes, including inflammatory effects and cortisol having to do with stress response and the like. And Also, they computed an index known as allostatic load, which is proving, courtesy of Bruce Ewan and others, to be a rather effective predictor of a variety of disease risks. What we wanted to do was add to that model a focus on environmental stressors and look at cumulative effects that were both chronic and acute. And our emphasis is on air pollution and inhalation effects because the location of this study is in Texas City. Texas City is the home to three major refineries, a number of chemical plants, and the city itself is located right along the fence line of these industrial point sources. And the National Air Toxics Assessment was being released this March, provided data that coincided with the gathering of the biomarker data, the serum-based markers for physiologic stress. The National Air Toxics Assessment also set in 2005 would give us exposure estimates on a census tract basis that we could then relate to variations in these blood-based biomarkers. And what we're trying to do then is sort through several kinds of environmental exposures, principally to air toxics, but also including monitoring data on PM and ozone levels. And we want to include acute data from episodes that in Texas are known as upset events. Upset events involve substantial releases of pollutants that are framed as accidental. And over a given year, they can constitute 400 or 500 episodes of releases that accumulate to the point where they almost represent a as substantial amount as the inventory pollutants that are reported to the state and indirectly to EPA. So we're trying to understand better how those acute emissions, those effects on different neighborhoods are related to these chronic exposures measured through the National Air Toxics Assessment, and in turn how they impact in both a direct and indirect way our indicators of cumulative biologic stress that are reflected in these biomarkers. We expect that our environmental stressors will have a portion of a direct effect on the biologic markers for stress, as well as an indirect effect through not only psychological stressors, but the neighborhood conditions and in turn related to social stressors. Now, what we're trying to do in order to sort out both the direct and indirect effects and come up with some indication of which of these relationships is stronger in a relative sense than others of the relationships is to model these things simultaneously using data that allows us to estimate the relative impact of each of these factors on others that we've connected them to and hypothesize in relationship to. And to be able to do that in a way that's analogous, I think, to the way we model the economy. When you think about how we predict the impact of money supply or unemployment on economic growth, there's a fairly sizable structural equation model of how the economy behaves and how factors in the economy are related one to another in functional form. We're doing the same thing, understanding this stress system to eventually be able to improve how we assess cumulative risk. We want to know which of these variables happen to be relatively more potent than others, what kinds of potency we're looking at, and what the chain of causality is through both neighborhood-based and individual-level characteristics in their impact on these biological predictors of disease risk. So ultimately, we want to be able to say something about how to improve cumulative risk assessment by knowing what counts and what doesn't. And we want to be able to say something about where we ought to target mitigation, whether it's on the environmental side or on the side of social disadvantage, because in a relative sense, we ought to know where the contributions are coming, and we can say something about how resources ought to be allocated for the mitigation of either disadvantage and or these pollutant emissions. That's if the model works, and we're anticipating that it works. And our interactions with the community then will be helping us understand some of the links that may not have been hypothesized that come out of our modeling effort. Some of the outlying relationships that don't appear to make sense may well make sense when they're contextualized and we understand better what the pattern of living is around those fence line neighborhoods. There's been a lot of work done in those neighborhoods already by a team led by a geographer to try and sort through what the impact of place is on health there in Texas City, and we hope to take advantage of that and have those folks on our team, along with the principal investigator from the medical branch study of health disparities. And we're expecting to be finished in about a year and a half. So we're at the stage now where we're sorting through neighborhood-level indicators and looking at all of our pollution data to try and sort through the relationship between acute effects and chronic effects. Then we're going to generate some measurement models and put the whole thing into a structural equation model, and then try and interpret our parameters and bring community leaders to help us interpret the results and see what the implications are for risk assessment and risk screening methodologies. The one screening methodology that we're using as kind of a benchmark is EJ SEAT, which is an Environmental Justice Strategic Enforcement Assessment Tool. We hope to actually come up with some improvement in how that tool works by understanding better what some of the internal relationships are, and instead of just using indicators, we'll be able to use relationships. And that's probably all you want to know about this.
I'm sure many want to know a lot more, Stephen, but thank you so much for that overview. And it's fascinating to me to see how different each one of these projects are, and particularly in contrast to some of the projects we heard about last week. I do want to just note there is a blog question from Nancy Myers to you regarding an open access. Is there an open access report on the 2005 Texas City Health Disparity Study? And if so, could you send a link? So
yeah, there's actually. I think that there's been 7 papers published. And because it was funded by NIH, they all ought to be in PubMed. It'll take me a little while to look those up, but I'll do that. And if you can tell me where to put them, I'll do that.
Yeah, that's very kind of you. And I'll make sure that, we'll be in touch with Nancy Myers as well.
Okay.
All right. So thank you. And given our the limited time, we're going to move along to the next project, and Madeline Scammell, who's at Boston University School of Public Health, Department of Environmental Health, and she is going to present with her community partner, Rosa Maria Olategui. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. Rosa Maria is with the STAR program, and she's a coordinator of that at the Chelsea Collaborative. So, Madeline?
Great.
Like to...
Thank you, Elise. Thank you, Erica. And thank you, Carolyn, for the very generous introduction and for framing this call in the context of CBPR. And thank you also to all of our STAR colleagues who presented last week and today. This is very exciting. So this Our project is indeed a partnership with the Chelsea Collaborative in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Roseanne Bongiovanni is the Associate Director of the Collaborative and also heads the Green Space Committee, which is one of several committees under the umbrella of the Collaborative, the organization. We have worked on a number of projects together prior to this grant, including a particulate matter monitoring project and an environmental justice mapping project. And Roseanne helped to write the grant along with David Ozanoff here at the School of Public Health, BU. And Greg Howard, who's listening in, I believe, who's at Dickinson College now. So part of the impetus for responding to this RFA was that in 2003, the Chelsea Collaborative participated with the EPA's Region 1 on what was called a community-based comparative risk assessment. And the purpose of the effort was for residents in the city of Chelsea and neighboring East Boston to identify and make recommendations for the improvement of issues of greatest concern. And concerns identified were ambient air quality, water quality, open space, green space, asthma and respiratory ailments, noise, and traffic. They also discovered that understanding cumulative impacts of social and chemical stressors was not possible in that risk assessment, nor was it easy to obtain data at the local or neighborhood level. So Roseanne couldn't be on the call today, but Rosemarie, as you know, is our full-time project coordinator, and she will speak. I just want to stop for a second. I'm using a speakerphone. Can everybody understand all right, like here, okay?
I believe so.
Great. Okay, thanks. Okay, so the status of our research now is that we've submitted our protocol to our institutional review board and are waiting for a response to begin interviews. And our first aim is to use established research techniques to gather qualitative and quantitative data via 500 in-depth, in-person interviews with residents in neighborhoods of Chelsea that abut a designated port area. And a few words about Chelsea. It's a very small, densely populated city northeast of Boston. It's 1.8 square miles and about 38,000 residents, according to the census. Some would say a lot more than that unofficially. And in 2001 and 2005, Chelsea was ranked in statewide analyses by Danny Faber and Eric Krieg as the third most intensively overburdened community in the state in terms of land use, waste sites, and polluting industries. So our research, where we'll do our interviews, is focused on five census tracts abutting the port that runs into Boston Harbor. And these tracts have a tremendous diversity in type of housing, racial and ethnic makeup, educational status, and income of residents. Four of the five tracts have, on average, 65 to 80% Latino residents, 20 to 30% living below poverty level, and 90% renter-occupied housing. So we'll analyze some of the qualitative data using standard social science methods I'm happy to elaborate on. And likewise, some of the quantitative responses will be analyzed with regression analyses suitable for survey data. So we're not expecting our findings of these analyses to be generalizable to other populations. We hope to generate hypotheses about relationships between variables to learn, for example, about a correlation between experience of intimate partner violence and self-reported cardiovascular disease, and proximity to trees, access to parks, and respiratory health. But we also hope to provide descriptive statistics about these specific populations that will be useful for the Chelsea Collaborative and the City of Chelsea. That being said, our response to the RFA published by EPA really focuses on the development of novel analytic methods, which we don't know if they'll definitely work, for examining cumulative risk and burden. And we plan to do this by testing mathematical methods of data analysis for their ability to analyze qualitative and quantitative pieces together, examining our data for patterns of combinations among our variables. And so I'm just going to back up a minute. When we think about cumulative risk, the first challenge is characterizing how things accumulate or add up. Maybe it's an additive effect, maybe it's synergistic, but it all requires that we count the same units. And of course, not all of our data elements will have the same units. You can't add 10 inches to 3 seconds or living near a highway and feeling insecure about immigration status. So just the same, even though we know that, we always try to construct a common scale for adding units in risk assessment and epidemiology. For example, we use pack years for cumulative smoking, combining the element of time and concentration of exposure. A pack year is a pack of cigarettes smoked for 1 year, but 20 pack years could be one pack of cigarettes a day for 20 years or 20 packs a day for 1 year. And while assumed to be the same for analytic purposes, we all know they're not the same. So our new approach is grounded in mathematics from graph theory and computer science incorporated into software used for data visualization and analysis. David Ozanoff has been developing what he refers to and now what we all refer to as the Lattice software using formal concept analysis with his collaborator Alex Pogel at the New Mexico State University Department of Mathematics. Since 2006, they've published two papers on their use of formal concept analysis in epidemiology, both published in computer science literature. The Lattice software doesn't add things up, but it does allow, as I said, for visualization and analysis of distinct combinations of variables. And our goal is to further develop the epidemiologic applications of the software while applying formal concept analysis to cumulative burden or risk. Epidemiology has previously relied almost exclusively on statistical tools, although mathematical techniques that do not depend on comparable units have long been used in the social sciences. And we are learning from the social sciences about what it means to be stressed and the experience of stressors, a really different type of information than we are getting from toxicology and epidemiologic studies on the same topic of stress and stressors. So we hope to develop new insights from our own analyses as well as from the other grantees, I might add. We're going about it in very different but complementary ways, I believe. So in terms of environmental burden and assets, we have data on high traffic roadways and traffic volume, waste sites, toxic release inventory, and industry, things we can get freely from data sources typically available for any area. But we also have the advantage of having data from two projects in Chelsea that identified healthy food purchasing locations throughout the city, and another that did a complete tree inventory of tree coverage on every street. Both of those were CBPR projects. So now Rosa Maria will say more about the additional data we plan to collect in our interviews with Chelsea residents.
Thank you, Madeleine. Yes, I will talk about that. But first, I would like to talk about the Chelsea Collaborative, its committees, and how they participated in developing the interview guide. The Collaborative has a number of different committees. For instance, the Chelsea Latino Immigrant Committee, the Chelsea United in Defense of Education, Vecinos Unidos, Chelsea White Tenants Association, Green Space, the Somali Bantu Group, and ECO, Environmental Chelsea Organizers. The STAR team met with each group at their monthly meeting, in most cases meeting with them twice. We posed the questions. If you have the opportunity to ask 500 Chelsea residents about social and environmental issues, what would you ask? And the other question was, what information from Chelsea residents it's important for your committee to know? During the first meeting, the STAR team explained the project. The team also asked about the committee goals and tasks. Committee's members asked about how to use the information that the project would gather in the community. There was a brainstorm exercise through which community members share important topics and questions that they wanted to include in the interview guide. During the second meeting, committee's members and the STAR team attempted to develop more specific questions based on the topics they shared in the previous meeting. We also included other concerns regarding social and environmental problems in Chelsea. So the Chelsea Collaborative Committees actively participated in the creation of the interview guide, which we submitted to IRB. During the same period of time, Madeleine and I drafted the guide with input from other members of the team, and we also borrowed and adapted different tools, including the CDC Environmental Assessment Collective Efficacy Survey, Neighborhood and Block Conditions, the Multi-Group Ethnic Identity Measure, the NHANES questionnaires, the BRFS questionnaires, and Krieger's study on reactions to race. The final draft of the interview guide includes sections with questions about social environment, ethnic identity, physical environment, individual health status, life stressors, community involvement, and demographics, including immigration and employment status. I also would like to mention particular areas of questioning that came from the input of our committees, as for instance, community lighting of streets and walkways, trash pickup and recycling, relaxation and exercising recreation, use of parks and green areas in the city, for example, where to walk your dogs or to bring your children, religious affiliations and community participation, civic engagement, parents' participation at schools, language barriers, and cultural adaptation and other immigrant issues. I also want to add from the last call that it is very important to us that since we are conducting the study within a predominantly Spanish-speaking population, we have planned a process for ensuring that the Spanish and English forms of the questionnaire are both appropriate tools for engaging individuals so that we get genuine and valid answers, and that the answers in both languages will be culturally and linguistically comparable. We have done this by borrowing existing questionnaires in English and Spanish, but we also have bilingual and monolingual staff involved in the process, a professional translator will be involved in the process, and a process for testing the guide for equivalence between questions, instructions, and responses in each language. I finally should say that the collaborative is looking forward to getting data from the interviews that might inform further environmental justice organizing and advocacy campaign in the city of Chelsea. We are particularly interested in responses to questions about odors and noise and use of green space and access to water. The areas we are targeting for interviews are of particular interest to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rosa Maria. It's incredible to have your kind of insight and expertise as part of this project, and very much appreciate your participation. I would like to now turn this over to Carolyn to kind of kick off the Q&A, but I want to note that, again, that Debbie needs to be off shortly, and so if there are particular questions for Debbie, that would be great to start with those. But Carolyn, you are welcome to start with whatever question you like, and then we'll have Erica switch everyone into Q&A mode.
Oh, well, I'm so intrigued by all of the research that's going on. I think my question is, whether you see possibilities for intervening and either restoring health or employing the precautionary principle to prevent harm in the future, and where you see those places, those points of intervention in your work. And so I'm going to leave it very broad-based to see what kinds of things you've already come up with, and I know that you have.
Thank you, Carolyn. Anyone would like to jump in and respond to that? I know it's a big question. Debbie, before you get off, is...
Well, we are trying to ask those questions a bit in animal models. You may be familiar with... There are two issues, really. One are some studies that have gone on in animal models with some similarities in human studies looking at, in animal models, what we call environmental enrichment kinds of activities, and there are similar things in the human literature, to determine whether or not those can mitigate some of these kinds of effects. And I think it's at a relatively early stage, and I would venture to say that the animal approach really needs to be a lot more like what goes on in a human environment. I think there's an interesting component to the stress literature, and this is certainly being reported in both human and animal studies, and that's the notion that early stress itself leads to a kind of resilience. You can sort of imagine this, I think, from your own experience, that having stressful experiences kind of prepares you better for subsequent behavioral experiences or other kinds of experiences. And people are beginning to try to determine what the markers are for that. What is it associated with physiologically? It's manifest sometimes in things like actually improvements in cognitive tests and some of those kind of things. So I think there's work to do. I still think the one missing piece on both sides is that we know there are these developmental kinds of exposures. We know they can affect things like learning or memory, but in the real world, people have lots of behavioral experiences and environmental encounters after birth, and we know very little about how your lifetime trajectory might feed back into what those developmental insults by itself and modify things.
Thank you, Debbie. Before you do need to leave, I just noted that Ted Shedler had posted a question on the blog for you, and you alluded to biomarkers, but he was asking, are you measuring any biomarkers, and if so, which ones? So if you could speak to that, that'd be great.
Well, we measure a lot of, I would presume by biomarkers, he's referring to peripheral kinds of markers. And we've done a little bit of that. What I typically don't see a lot of correlation, but for example, we've measured profiles of cytokines in the blood. They don't look like the profiles that you get in the brain, and so it's really... At this point, I don't think we've come up with anything, nor have I seen anyone else, that I think would be predictive of what might be going on in the brain, at least in terms of a peripheral biomarker.
Great. Thank you, Debbie. Others, I'm just returning to the sort of broader question that Carolyn posed about points of intervention and sort of restorative action and taking action based on the precautionary principle. Would anyone else like to speak to that?
This is Madeline. My first sort of thought when Carolyn asked that question was, let me count the ways that the precautionary principle has influenced this project. And I think for me, the biggest piece is working with the Chelsea Collaborative and our standards for what's considered certainty in terms of evidence that we need to move forward in terms of protecting public health are not always the same. And it's very exciting to work with a group that says, well, we need to do something now, even if it's going to take us another 4 years to analyze all of this data.
Great. Thank you. Erica, why don't you go ahead and switch us all into Q&A mode so that others on the call can ask their questions.
Sure. Just one moment, everyone. So thank you for waiting again. I just want to remind everyone that if you wish to make a comment or ask a question at this time, you still need to unmute your line by pressing the star key and then the number 6. So star 6 will unmute you. If you could identify yourself before your comment and keep your remarks brief so that we have time to get to as many questions as possible, that would be great. Also, when you are done with your question or comment, if you could again press star 6 to remute yourself, that will help us to keep excess noise down on the line as others speak. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Erica. And others are welcome to respond to Carolyn's question, or there may be some other comments and questions people would like to raise.
This is Ted Shetler. I have a question for Stephen. It's a fascinating proposal and study. It wasn't clear to me from what you said, or maybe I missed it, Stephen, how much variability there actually is in the neighborhoods that you will be studying. And the reason I'm asking the question is because I've long wondered whether there might be some utility in developing an idea called an inflammatory neighborhood index, where we might identify various characteristics of neighborhoods that are reflected in some of the inflammatory markers that you will have access to in the individuals who live in those. And but doing that kind of thing would depend on having neighborhoods with enough variability so you'd actually get kind of a spectrum of responses. So I guess there are two parts to my question. One is whether your data set and analysis would in any way lend itself to that notion of a neighborhood inflammatory index, which is obviously something that I've sort of dreamt up and isn't widely used. And secondly, whether you have the kind of variability in your neighborhoods that would allow that to happen.
Actually, it would indeed. When the original sample was taken, the emphasis was on trying to include virtually every household that had anyone over 65 in the household, as well as a random selection of those of Mexican descent and Anglo households for ages from 18 up to 64. The amazing thing about allostatic load, for example, is that it's highly associated with age. And so you have to immediately control for age before you look for other kinds of inflammatory responses. Once you control for age, there is a certain amount of variability if you look at census tract levels. And there is in Texas City, we're looking at 10 different census tracts in Texas City, and so you can expect the largest to the smallest to vary almost by a factor of 10, and that includes the pollution data as well. Otherwise, there wouldn't be much to model, as it turns out. But I think we're seeing that kind of variability, and the variability has to do with whether or not the neighborhoods are downwind from the plants and what the prevailing wind is during the season and so on, and so we're trying to model all of that as well. But I think you're onto something with inflammatory response, and if you get into the literature on allostatic load, you'll find that people are trying to pull apart what is a 10-indicator composite to get at different aspects of inflammation and use it as a predictor for a variety of disease states.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? Well, this is Elise. I will just raise a question that came up on last week's call because I thought it was very useful to just put that out there, and that is why or if, whether nutrition is integrated into any of the work. And I was thinking of some of the data that Debbie and Katrina were going to look at in terms of the Rochester cohort. I didn't know if any of that data included nutritional information and whether that might be included in this analysis. Katrina, are you still on? Maybe she had to get off of the same call.
I am, and I don't know if that's one of the variables they're planning on looking at, but I do believe that's in the data set.
It is in the data set. Mm-hmm. Great. And Madeline? Or
I'm sorry, at least having to do with calcium and iron.
Calcium and iron. Okay, great.
Okay. Yeah, we're asking about food consumed, fast food, and preferences for healthy food choices.
Right.
And then we also have like the map of where we have, where this other project measured actual healthy food choice buying places.
Great, thank you.
But we're looking at some behavioral risk factors, and we have BMI and established overweight and so on to deal with it as a risk factor. That moderates other kinds of effects. We had actually thought about including ferritin, which is looking at iron in the blood that's correlated really highly with zinc, which is a marker for lots of metabolic processes that are necessary for health, and weren't able to yet to get supplemental money to reanalyze the blood samples for ferritin levels. If we're able to locate another funding source, we'll do that and add it on as a supplement, because I'd love to be able to look at nutritional differences across this population and understand how it interacts with these other factors.
Great. Thank you all. Other questions?
This is Ted again. Again, for Stephen. In your structural equation modeling, are you able to take into account the timing of these various features? What I'm getting at is when you start to mix the pollution together with these various neighborhood and other characteristics, they don't always, the timing for an individual it may matter a lot. So you have some elders, as you just described, who may or may not have lived there all their lives, and then the kids who probably have, or maybe you know that they have lived there all their lives. But I'm just thinking, when you start to mix these things together and you start to, you know, these feedback loops begin to emerge, the timing of the onset of the variables can sometimes influence the way the feedback loops work. Are you going to be able to take timing into account?
Not in the structural equation model itself. What we're doing as a preliminary to that is to construct more of a configural representation that's actually a time-based data set, so that we're taking all of the dates from the first blood draw to the last, which is about a two-year period, and then matching those dates up with these acute pollution release events, and with the meteorology connected with those events and the location and distance of those households from those event sites, to see if there's a temporal pattern there that we can understand a little better about the acute effects once you control for all of the chronic effects that have to do with the day-to-day exposures. And so we're hoping to see a temporal relationship there. It would get averaged out when we went into the structural equation model. So we're actually doing this in multiple rounds before we get to the full structural equation test. But the short answer is no. It's not part of the structural equation modeling evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
This is Madeline. Another question for Stephen. And maybe you said this, and I'm sorry if you said it already, but do you have any survey data or information from the households where you've got the biomarkers from about other life stressors?
Yes. They used a number of stress inventories. I've just pulled up a couple of the articles that were published off the health disparities study, whose data set we're actually using for our modeling. And I can send those to Erica, and she in turn, I guess, could send them on to whoever would like to see those. And that may be the most complete answer, because then you can track it down and see. They had a social psychologist on the team as one of the co-PIs, and she had a fairly elaborate set of psychosocial stress indicators, because that was one of their key variables that they were attending to in the health disparities study. It really was, in fact, the title of the study was Stress and Health Disparities. So I think you'll find kind of a treasure trove of measures that they use there. Our focus is not primarily on the psychosocial mechanisms, but rather on the physiological ones.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Hi, this is Mark Rallis. I'm at the EPA in the policy office.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for some great presentations, interesting stuff. I was interested to hear someone mention EJC, which is a screening tool for environmental justice analysis. And I've been leading a team that's developing a new nationally consistent environmental justice screening tool, sort of the next generation, building on EJC and some of the others. And what we're trying to do is screen communities across the entire nation, combining indicators of potential exposure as well as indicators of a community's vulnerability. And one of the big challenges that we've been facing is data, or lack of data. And what we really would like is nationwide coverage and high geographic resolution, so ideally better than county level, ideally better than census tract level. But we often don't have that kind of information that's comprehensive and high resolution. And I'm wondering if some of the speakers could comment on which markers or predictors of stress or vulnerability are currently available comprehensively at some high geographic resolution, or what are the prospects for actually collecting those data? Because we don't have it in NHANES, we don't have it in, we have a few demographic variables now in the New American Community Survey, but I see that as a real obstacle.
Thank you, Mark. Comments on that response?
This is Stephen. It's great to hear that there'll be a new generation of assessment tools coming out that's focusing on the issues that are necessary to prompt enforcement. So if you've got a tool that communities can use,